WQXM again, Rich, Golf X-Ray Mike. I was joking with someone today about having a portable dumbbell in your pocket. Would weigh nothing until you brought it out, flip the switch, and it would become 50 pounds. I think that's a job for the Higgs boson, WBGGXM.
That sounds good, Mike. No, Rich. Sorry about that. It sounds good. You're assuming that the Higgs boson is a accessible device of some kind that has an on-off switch. That various people have said the Higgs boson creates gravity. Well, I think that's an oversimplification. It ties in with the origin of all of those other subatomic particles, the quarks, up, down, and strange quark, and their dualities. So it ties in, and you can say it creates gravity. I'm having trouble with that. Because matter is something, the usual definition of matter is something that has mass and occupies space. Okay? So everything we call matter has mass and occupies space. That implies that everything that we call matter, if the Higgs boson makes gravity, then gravity is there. And can you turn off gravity and float your flying saucer without it? Great to dream about that. I think we're a long way from confirming that that great piece of science fiction. Wouldn't that be nice if that science fiction turned out to be real? Does V2GXM? Tell us how you would develop this further, Rich. K2RAW.
Yeah, let's see now. Well, probably wouldn't be a real on-off switch. Let's see. You'd have to develop the Higgs boson a little bit, but eventually I'll bet you this portable dumbbell would work. I mean, look, the airplane was a dream. The telephone was a dream. Everybody said these things wouldn't work. So there you go, WB2GXM.
Yeah, you can create a Higgs boson. All you need is a miles in diameter.
One problem, I'm still trying to figure the one guy at the end, I guess because of security, the one scientist, he was a little late getting back, and he says he sent a text calling somebody else in the auditorium, you know, they won't let me in. He had to listen to the whole thing on the outside of the door. That was terrible. Back to you there.
The James Webb Space Telescope at $10 billion, if it's being funded by your and my taxes, represents $30.30 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. $10, $30.30, assuming we've got 330 million residents. Development of the James Webb is spread out over roughly 10 years, so it's $3 per year for every man, woman, and child, which turns out to be around 25 cents a month. So, are you willing to invest 25 cents a month to get all the pleasure we're going to get out of the James Webb Space Telescope? How are you, Paul? K2LIW? Here's my money.
Okay, very good. Yeah, but you know the argument, you know, okay, there's another 25 cents going to the space station, you know, the upkeep of that, and another 25 cents for all the other future satellites, and the teacher, and the list goes on and on, the avionics that NASA is working at. You know, if those people had their way, they'd shut the whole thing down, and the amount of jobs it would cost would be phenomenal. I think the Apollo program, I remember 400,000 people were involved working, and who knows how many people are working on James Webb Space Telescope. There's a lot of people involved with all these different projects. I was talking about the 45th Space Wing earlier. You know, they shut down the East Coast to work on that. When that's in operation and there's lights going up, there's almost 10,000 civilian and military people part of the 45th Space Wing. Just 10,000, just in monitoring and controlling everything and watching out that boats on and aren't in the way of flight. Thousands of people making salaries, and they go to delis and gas stations, you know, really makes the world go around. So to shut down the James Webb Space Telescope, okay, you'd be losing a lot more than a quarter, 50 cents a year. You'd be losing a lot more than that. Back to you there.
I vaguely remember, Paul, you told me that the total budget for NASA these days is around $18 billion per year, total NASA budget. $54 for man, woman, and child in the United States. And not all of those children are really working, so among the working people, it's probably closer to $100 a year per person that are really employed or have got some kind of a salary or they're getting their social security, so to speak. That's around $100 a year per man. But that money, just like you said, is not just being put into a hole in the ground. It's paying the salary of people that are actively working and doing things, buying houses, buying candy at the local store, beer, raising kids. They're really doing something. So, like you said, if you cancel NASA and think you're going to save $18 billion, you may have mentioned what is the total population of NASA. I'm going to pick a number out of the air. Maybe it's 50,000 people. Cancel NASA, and maybe you're going to put 50,000 people out of work. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, and it's not only the people that work for NASA. That's the drop in the bucket. It's NASA employees, thousands of, I don't know about thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people indirectly through private contracts. You know, SpaceX is being paid by NASA to, you know, bring up their cargo vehicles. Orbital ATK, more cargo vehicles. Sierra Nevada Corporation building the Dream Chaser, another one that's going to be going up to the space station in 2019. All these places have people work for them, not to mention Boeing and Lockheed. Lockheed is building the Orion spacecraft. Part of Lockheed and Boeing together collectively are in charge of the United Launch Alliance, the ULA, which launch all the main rockets for the government and for NASA. You know, the list goes on and on. It's still probably 400,000 people collectively, if not more, throughout the United States and for the world. We're involved with ESA, you know, European Space Agency, involved with a lot of people up in Canada building robotic arms. The list goes on and on. Probably collapse the economy if the science community ever went under.
And there's a hell of a lot of people who believe that they have a purpose in life because they're doing something that they really enjoy that comes close to a kind of pure research in something. Out of all of those planets really work? How do they evolve? How do we build better spacecraft? How do we build better unmanned spacecraft, unmanned probes that go to places like Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, and so on? But gotta have some far-reaching goals where the end product is not clearly defined. A skeptical person can easily say, how does the man in the street benefit out of what NASA does? Depends on which man and which street. Like you said, there's probably 400,000 people altogether employed directly, indirectly, as vendors, as subcontractors, and so on. I mean, I think you're going to save money. Let me drop it. And not have to pay taxes. Well, are you going to cancel all military contracts, cancel all NASA contracts? How far do you take that? How vulnerable do you come when you do it? How much can you change the system without upsetting the apple cart? Trump thinks he's going to make some great big changes that are going to make improvement. He's going to empty the swamp. Remains to be seen. I think he's down to, what, 35% approval rating these days, some number like that. And does he stand a chance of being elected again in 3.5 years? Some people who think no. There are some dyed-in-the-wool Republicans that are absolutely positive he's doing exactly what he should be doing. Yeah, he's a bit of a bull in the china shop, but he's doing things, and you have to expect some glass is going to be broken. The person whose opinion I respect told me that. He's a Republican, obviously. You and I know some Democrats who think he's the worst person in the world that should ever become president. No perfect solution to any of this. Make changes if you want to, but do it slowly. And don't make radical changes, because you may not understand the whole equation, so to speak. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I just saw a good show on I forget what channel that was, but they talked about the coal industry compared to all the people that are employed with the wind industry and solar panels around the world, what these other countries are doing, how many people are involved with modern, eco-friendly power systems. Yeah, we're missing the boat here. We're doing a lot. I mean, Elon Musk is building a lot of solar panels for Solar City. He owns that. But, you know, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's going on in China and India. So, it talked about the budget. Yeah, it used to be $18 billion for the last couple of years. And then last year, 2016, it went up a billion, so just over $19 billion. And then this year, for some reason, Trump signed the thing and he just deducted $100 million. I don't know where they got the number from, but he took away $100 million. It officially doesn't go through. He's still got to get passed with Congress. I mean, it's just a number, an imaginary number right now until something really gets passed. You know, one understanding, signing papers after paper, and nothing's really truly getting done. So all I can say is, the answer to the question is probably $19 billion right now. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to the space program that the government is running, the military. We double or triple that just for the space program that the military is doing. Back to Dick.
Repeat. You already timed out the last second, Paul. NASA program is close to $19 billion. Okay, you believe that our military has its own space program. I guess you're talking about security satellites and whatever. I would guess does global positioning satellites, do they come under civilian or military? But we do have a number of military security satellites believe that their budget could be as large as the NASA budget? And are those in the past, weren't some of those satellites being launched with the space shuttle, so therefore they're being launched with NASA hardware? Over to you on that one, Paul, K2IW.
Sure, I'm going to take
that was the plan, but it didn't work out because of the Challenger. So they went up on expendable vehicles. Eventually, the military got away from the space shuttle, finally. They were going to start launching from Vandenberg Airport space shuttle. You know, they were ready to go in the 1980s, but Challenger happened, and that was the end of that. I heard a station that back here.
I'm pretty sure that was Gary, W2MIT here. Hey, Gary, straighten us out on all this spending that we're making.
K2MIT, Jeffrey, am I making the repeater okay? And I have two comments.
You sound good, Jeffrey.
Yes, GPS falls under the military. It can be encrypted in a moment's notice, so no one can use it. KH-11, the spy satellites, and the successors were all launched on Delta. 5 heavy launch vehicles from Vandenberg Air Force Base, occasionally from Kennedy Space Center, and then I want to comment on system dynamics. Let me drop it. Dynamics was a science which is essentially looking at how feedback loops occur in systems like nature, in politics, in the economy. It was developed by Jay Forrester at MIT during World War II to keep aircraft radar pointed at an enemy aircraft while battleships and cruisers were pitching. So we had to figure out how to compensate for, build a feedback system so the antenna was pointed continuously at its target regardless of which way the ship was going. It's been used to model positive loops and negative loops. So you take money out of R&D 1 year, second year you have less products, therefore your revenues may go down. A lot of politicians make policy without understanding the macro, large-scale system dynamic effects of what they're going to do.
That's a very desirable set of call letters you got there, Jeff, K2MIT. My first question, is that a vanity call? And second of all, the military hardware that you're describing, do you have a rough guess as to how many dollars it's costing per year? Over to you, Jeff.
DARPA budget alone is, CR drive tunnel, sorry if I dropped it, but, military satellites, and now developing, anti-satellite weaponry, as the Chinese have just launched, and failed to, launch a, anti-satellite direct launch missile, we're developing defenses against that. That in itself is a big chunk of change. I personally believe it's multiples of the NASA budget.
Could easily be. Since you used to be KC2, yeah, I think it is. I'm guessing MIT is a very nice selected vanity call. I see now you've got an extra class license, yes. Chose MIT. Out of curiosity, you were a graduate of MIT, Jeff?
Yes, and I had the pleasure of taking classes with John Forrester and, oh my gosh, his name just escapes me. The guy invented high-speed photography, the milk drop photograph. My memory is blanking. It was the last year that he was there. Harold Edgerton, there we go. Wonderful man. Taught a lot of great courses in physics, and Jay Forrester changed my life with the study of system dynamics. It's essentially a spreadsheet that iterates through time. You take the output of one cell, if it's a positive loop, a positive input means a positive output. If it's a negative loop, a positive input means a negative output, and it's been used to model tax refunds, to social policy, to birth rates, to a lot of different things, and get more politicians studied sort of the macroeconomic effects of what they were doing, not just a single bill, they might think twice.
Sounds good. And you work with Edgerton, the high-speed photographer guy. I may be pronouncing it wrong. From your recollection, what's the fastest pictures he was able to take? Was he getting into the sub-nanosecond, into the picosecond area, to your knowledge? Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I think he was at the time at a million frames a second or something crazy like that. I know there are now cameras that do in the billion second. It's amazing when you think about a million shots in a second. Personally, I don't have read about it. His famous milk drop photo was done, I believe, at a thousandth of a second, so it really wasn't all that amazing, but he was one to think about it. And it's really the strobographic effect that really froze it, not the speed of the shutter, but the speed of the shutter and the strobe, which was going off at a 10,000th of a second. That really froze the frame.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. A million frames per second might give you a slightly blurred picture, unless each individual frame, a million frames per second is a microsecond per frame, but if each individual frame has an exposure time of a nanosecond, you can take an awful lot of very fast motion and freeze it. So, and I guess you're saying by way of strobes, I don't know if he'd gotten very heavy into lasers. There are now lasers that'll make a light pulse of extremely fast periods of time. But he was doing things more with strobes than with lasers. Is that true, Jeff, K2LIW?
Yes, all of his was with flash photography. And I should say, I think it was in the 1870s, there was a debate as to whether horses picked up all 4 feet at one time. And it was through high-speed photography that they filmed the horse, I think running on a treadmill or running on a track. Yeah, I think it was a treadmill because the camera stayed still. And I can't remember the exposure, but there was a couple of frames out of several thousands where all 4 feet of the horse were in the air at one time.
I've seen some documentaries on that. I think they set up a whole bunch of cameras alongside of a track. The horse tripped each one of those wires and set off each one of those cameras. That's what took those individual frames. At least one of the attempts was done that way, Jeff, go ahead.
That's right, Dick, I saw that.
And then they put it together like a flip book and sort of made it into a movie and looked at it, and what, lo and behold, all four hoofs were off the ground, I think for two of the frames.
That horse doesn't even know what he's doing, but he's doing it very well. I guess that's really the beginning of cinematography. What do you think, Jeff?
Exactly. Exactly. Put a bunch of pictures together, turn it into a flip book, or glue them together, and you've got cinematography. Realize it at the time, of course. You know, Doc Edgerton, as he likes to be called, would be very intrigued with lasers. Of course, they were around, but he just stayed focused with strobographic effects and did some just amazing things. Just Google his name and some of the pictures. The milk drop is just the beginning. My favorite is the bullet going through a balloon, and you can see the convex exit of the bullet, and then in another frame, the convex thing implodes back into the balloon. It's amazing.
I do remember seeing some of those pictures, and there were a lot of exciting things that, when slowed down and carefully documented, I get very exciting pictures where you figure out almost at the particle level what's going on. When it comes to very fast stroboscopic-like effects, had you listened to some of the earlier TechNets a year or two ago? I occasionally went into the description of what I was doing at Edwards Air Force Base. I literally constructed a 10 gigahertz radar that transmitted pulses of a quarter of a nanosecond each pulse. Pulses per second, quarter of a nanosecond each pulse. So each pulse was three cycles of a 10 gigahertz sine wave. That constituted the pulse generator for a radar, which only had a range of probably 1,000 feet before you start getting multiple responses. But it gave me a radar with a quarter of a foot of range resolution. I was using that to find the reflecting objects inside of a very large anechoic chamber. So a quarter of a nanosecond pulses. Had to go to a very special guy in Canada that made a video pulse generator that worked that fast. and found a way of using doubly balanced mixers as the on-off switch that would generate those pulses. You may have heard some of that story. How are you, Jeff? K2RIW?
I did indeed. I am always, I don't check into the segment often enough. I'm always amazed at the breadth of what you've done and how easily you explain to people. So, Dick, my hat's off to you. You've done an amazing job. And I go, I know they're online someplace, and occasionally when I have time, I listen to some older ones, and they're just as relevant.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, I had no trouble hearing you on the input, and yeah, these are some of my bragging stories. That took place way back in 1990. What is that now? Wow. 27 years ago. Time to go out and do something a little bit more modern. But, when people first heard about my attempt to do that, they thought it was crazy. And then some of those people who were positive it was crazy told everybody they knew that this guy is wasting our time, wasting our resources. Some of those exact same people, when the idea worked and get desirable results, those exact same people who told everybody it's crazy started saying, I always knew it was a good idea. Taught me a lot about human nature. You've heard the expression so often that success has many fathers, and a failure is an orphan. So, as I said, it taught me an awful lot. Paul, got 15 minutes left. What do you think we should be talking about, Paul? WS2N, with the space report, K2RIW.
I have a space question for you. Andy said he was going to be back at 11:30. And Jeff, that's a great call, MIT. very good. Let's see if WA2CDL is out there.
Yeah, we had a double of somebody. I know WA2RYY wants to ask a question. And was there a second person? Because I heard a double. Okay, we'll find out. WA2RYY, go ahead, Joe. You got the floor. And the ceiling.
Okay, very good. I watched the video which I gave you and Paul several times recently, just paying more closer attention to it. This is a question probably more for Paul. It seems like exactly when they were launching the shuttle, just as it was lifting off, the engines seemed to be lit and are producing pretty much full power for about 3 seconds before they light the boosters. Is that because they're doing some sort of measurement of stress that the engines are able to produce to say, okay, you've got enough thrust, I'm going to light the boosters and let you go? My question is, are the rockets that are being launched by SpaceX, are these people doing the same thing nowadays, or they do something a little different? Back to you.
You've got a
final question if you want.
Yeah, the, let me make sure I didn't double.
Can I ask a shuttle question if you...
Okay. Yeah, Joe, the engines, first of all, they actually don't go off at the exact same time. There's a microsecond between those three main engines on the RS-25 shuttle engines. Naturally, they have a liquid fired, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, so they have to make sure they're up and running before they light those big solids. Once the solids light, that's it. They can't shut it off. The engines are running fine. There's some movement in there as well. You actuate them a little bit. Then the solids will go off. SpaceX is going to do the same. In fact, they run Falcon 9. Falcon 9, actually, every one of those engines that has these cameras that Dick and Jeff were talking about, you can see one rocket going, then another Merlin D going, another Merlin D going. They don't go off. They go off individually, every one of them. And the same is going to hold true with the Falcon Heavy, which when they have three boosters bolted together, they're going to have 27 engines. Every engine will fire differently. And for some reason, one just doesn't go off, the computer controller will shut the system down and they will abort. Same with the shuttle. If there was a problem, they would have shut it down, they would have aborted, and it's happened. And they'll shut it down. The engines will fire and they'll shut it down. And meanwhile, the solids never go off. Back to you, Jeff.
Did occur at one point.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you got a shuttle question and a comment. You got it, Jeff.
There's an answer. He points to light the SRBs. You can't turn them off, so they had to test the main engines at full throttle. And I think there was one shuttle where one of the three petered out and they didn't launch the solid rocket boost.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think there were a number of aborts of shuttle because of liquid engine malfunction. Isn't that true, Paul?
The valves.
Yeah, there were. There was more than one. Some of them, they would go to the launch pad five or six different times for different reasons, and they would abort. But I even saw it recently with one of the Antares rockets a couple of years ago, before that one blew up in 2014. It would ignite, and they would shut it down. SpaceX always takes their rockets 2 days before. They'll ignite those rockets, all of them, on the launch pad, and they'll shut it down. This way they know it's going to work. And then even during launch, they could abort after the ignition, after even all of them are, you know, all of them are being ignited, but are being held down in place. And until they get full thrust, they don't release that rocket.
But they are measuring full throw. That's what they're going for. I knew they do that with jet aircraft on a carrier. They'll make the thing go to full power, and they're measuring how much thrust the engines will produce to make sure that when they let that thing go, it's going to go off the decks. I figure they're doing the same thing with these shuttles or these other rockets, though, coming up to, with some sort of measurement to actually determine oil spring engines equal so much pull or so much thrust. So you once you light the solid boosters, you can't retract that.
It's really like the new electromagnetic launch catapult they have now.
Yeah, that's a nice sounding object, but how big a thing can you launch with that, do you believe? Go ahead.
Did you see the video? They had a sled that weighed, I think, 5,000 pounds they were testing it with. An FA-18 is considerably more, but it gets a Super Hornet up in the air, and I think those are 24,000 pounds.
Okay, is this a launching technique that's different than the catapult that's on a carrier? Go ahead.
Have a new Ford class carrier is bigger than it gets. They have steam-driven catapults. This one is an electromagnetic, not a railgun, but it uses an electromagnetic a slide. They hook it up, and through the same mechanisms as maglev trains, it launches an FA-18. Using the nuclear reactor electrical output, the generators, the nuclear engines on the Gerald Ford that was just commissioned, I think, 2 weeks ago, or went out to sea trials, are much greater than the Nimitz class, much larger ship, and has successfully, last week they successfully launched their first Super Hornet using the new technology.
I think that was another $10 billion project, I think.
Are you serious? $10 billion for that catapult? Or are you talking about the whole darn new carrier, Paul? Go ahead.
I heard that ship was $13 billion. They said it was $13 billion.
That's a couple of years over. It was supposed to be done a couple of years ago. But yeah, quite a project.
Now $14 billion, but then there's all the associated R&D.
And again, that was probably a 10 or 15 year project, is that what you believe, Paul?
I'm not sure who's talking, but Spellin had just said $14 billion. I think he's got more info. I thought it was 8 years, but go back to him, and I missed his call and name. But yeah, I knew it was at least $10 billion, but he's saying $14 billion.
You got it, Jeff. $14 billion, and Jeff is a K2MIT. You got it, Jeff.
Remember, you build a carrier, you got to build an airboat too. So that includes all the planes and the rescue helicopters and, even the little trucks that move the planes around and all that stuff. It all adds up. And I think that's just manufacturing costs and all the equipment costs. The development was done beforehand is included in that price. And that in itself was a lot of money. I don't know the exact total, but the ship itself, I believe, outfitted was $14 billion.
And you don't send out a aircraft carrier all by itself. It goes out with a whole fleet of gunships and destroyers and whatever to protect it.
Well, that they have. My point was, it's just three football fields, whatever the acreage is, and they got to build, you know, they got to build three carrier wings, ASW, anti-submarine warfare unit, you know, a helicopter recovery system, and, you know, special forces delivery systems, everything.
Quick question for Jeff.
Go ahead, Paul.
We were talking about the budget a while back. You mentioned DARPA, and then you were going to say how much the DARPA budget was, but that's where we lost you at one point. Maybe Dick heard you because he gets you on the input, but I didn't hear that. I was wondering what the DARPA budget was. I know $19 billion for NASA. So you going to say DARPA is...
I don't think they break it out, to be honest. I think it's one of those black budgets. I'm thinking it's multiple, to be honest. The latest project that has my intrigue is they put out a $150 million contract to begin the seeds of developing a chip that can be implanted in the brain so that the government can communicate and turn radio waves into thoughts or hearing in people's minds. That's the goal, and it was awarded about 3 weeks ago.
Very good. Yeah, that gives you a good idea. Thanks, Jeff. Back to you, Dick.
I'm pretty sure you know the answer to this one. It's a slight trick question, Jeff. When a fighter aircraft is about to land on an aircraft carrier, and he's about to be arrested by the tail hook and the wire system that's there, and the reverse catapult, the damping system, at the instant fighter aircraft wheels touch the carrier deck, what's the very first thing that the pilot does? Over you, Jeff.
Maybe throws it into reverse thrust, is my understanding, and the arrestor system on the Ford is also brand new. It is only three arrestor hooks, and it uses... I just saw an interview with the commanding officer, and they called it... It has something to do with water, like a reverse water generator. They didn't explain it, and I have to look it up, but it's a whole completely new system, and they have six arrestor hooks. This one only has three. I think six versus three. I'm not an expert. But they have a brand new, just like they have a brand new catapult system, they have a brand new arrestor system on the Ford class.
Comment? Comment, we'll get to you in a second. And you're close, Jeff. The instant the wheels touch the deck, the pilot shoves the stick, the throttle full forward power, not reverse. He doesn't have reverse thrust on a fighter. Full forward power. The reason for that is if he misses the arrestor hooks, once that engine to be spooled up, so when he comes off the end of that runway, he's able to fly again. So full forward thrust is put on at the instant the wheels touch the ground. A person with comment, go ahead, KQRIW.
I was referring to after the hook gets fixed.
CXK. Yes, you took the words out of my mouth, Dick. He's actually also aiming for the number two cable that's in it.
Dick, I misunderstood your question. Yes, of course. I was referring to once he has indication that the plane is, and he feels that the plane is hooked full reverse, but I believe they do have reverse. My understanding is that they do. It's actually on the F-35 they do.
I'll bet you very few of the fighter aircraft have reverse thrust, because particularly not a carrier aircraft. All that arresting has to be done by the tail hook. I don't think you want to use the reverse thrust. And if the reverse thrust ever gets deployed at the wrong time, you can be in an awful lot of trouble.
Probably right. I am well beyond my knowledge. I think it's commercial aviation that has reverse thrust.
Dick?
Yeah, I think it's Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Many years ago, I was at an air show out at West Hampton Beach, and they had a couple of Comcats out there, and I walked around the whole thing, walked behind them. Those engines are very big. And I asked the pilot a question. This would be a typical Dick question, and the question was, how many tracks do you get out of a tail hook? And the answer was about 20. What?
How many uses of the tail hook? Are you saying 20 uses and after that it has to be replaced because they wear it out in some way? Is that what you're saying, Joe?
That's right out of the pilot's mouth. That's exactly correct. I asked him how many tracks you get out of a tail hook, and he said about 20.
You said how many tracks? T-R-A-C-K-S? Is that the word you're saying?
Tracks.
T-R-A-P-S, traps.
Trapped, T-R-A-P-S. That's what they call, that's what, when the guy lands on the tower, he's called a trap.
Okay. And if you're one of the deckhands, you got to really be careful during that procedure. Because once in a while, that arresting wire frays and breaks. When it does, it comes whipping across the carrier deck at close to the speed of sound and will slice through any human being that happens to be in the way.
I saw that plane when one of the F-18s landed and a couple of I think it was back in 2005 or something like that. I saw exactly that video. It knocked people right clean off their feet.
Slice a plane in half if one was in the way.
So I guess you're saying you've seen some documentary movies, Jeff, where that wire did damage as it frayed?
No, I'm saying it has enough force to go through a plane, aluminum plane like butter. I've seen a guy get sliced in half in a documentary film. It's not nice, not pretty, and they tend to be on the sidelines.
When it comes to deck accidents, in my mind, the wrecked accident of all was an EA-6B aircraft on an aircraft carrier, engines being spooled up. Deckhand was somehow in front of that aircraft. He got sucked into the engine, managed to, with one hand, hang on to the edge of the forward cowl, and with the other hand, he held onto his flashlight so it didn't damage that engine. Survived that procedure. Wow.
6B's had pretty small inlets underneath. I'm surprised he fit through into it.
I've seen portions of that picture of how he got sucked in. And I'll bet you his legs got bent and all. I'll bet you he had all kinds of damage, but he did get sucked in. But lucky for him, he didn't get past the first compressor blade. Maybe the knob in the center of that blade is what he landed on. Or he hung onto the edge. I'm not quite sure how he did it. But the engine didn't get damaged, and he survived. Wild incident. Okay, we've used
interesting two underwing mounted pods that have little propellers that generate electricity for all of the electronics in it. It's up for 10,000 homes or something crazy like that. It's really is an amazing aircraft that Grumman built.
Yeah, you're talking about the ram air turbines on the front end of each one of those pods. That makes the energy that operates those jamming pods. We've used up our time. This was Technet number 1662. After 35 years, we're still doing this craziness. And that was Space Report number 262. We'll be back next week as long as we all stay healthy. Bye-bye, you all. Bye-bye for now. And Paul, you can tie the ribbons on if you want to. WS2N, K2LIW. Thank you. See you downrange.
Real good. Very good. 73, we'll be back next week. And we'll do this all over again. Mandy and Gavin, listen. Sorry we didn't get back to you. We might get the CDL. Dave's going to be back at 11:30, but we missed him. Next week, WS2N clear.
K2MIT, thank you for letting me participate. It was a pleasure. Good night, everybody.
Yeah, glad you joined us. Good information. Andy, the major CDL, if you're there, you can say something right now. And that guy, Joe, he's got to be careful. Periodically generates a standing wave ratio of 98,000 to 1. Wow.
Time is 12:04 p.m. 73, and good night from the W2 repeater.
Thank you. for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Pretty good.
minute. Now maybe you got it, little man. You don't come up here enough.
Yeah, I know. I haven't been on the air much. I just got a new vehicle 2 months ago, and I just got the video in the last few days. Don't have a permanent power connection. Permanent power. I had to get a glass out of the car because there's no place to put anything on this vehicle. But I'm leasing it, so I don't want to do that. Before that, I just kind of slacked off on a radio. So I'm back to the bank.
Okay, now. Well, I'm glad you're back on. I never gave up ham radio. Been a ham since 1905, when I was 15. Now I'm an old cook. I'm 67. I love it.
Okay.
And Eric.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm back. But you know, the issue is there's a couple issues here.
Vehicle is leased.
I don't own this one. So any hole drill and anything I do like that, I'm gonna have to pay for them to restore it when I return the vehicle, or else I'll have to restore it myself. So you know, it's not worth me putting in $500 to $1,000 for repairing stuff that they get away with. Because that's how they get you at the end of the week. No, they nickel and dime you on stuff. So I'm trying to stay away from it. And I just may have to change for a different antenna. But it's really, there's no point to drill an antenna unless I do it on the roof. Because everything's plastic and glass on this vehicle, except for the roof. Or the hood. No trunk, just a hatchback, and that's all plastic and glass.
Okay, now, so I guess it was long-winded. Like that. All right, I did not know the lease vehicle. What are you doing right now for an antenna?
I put a glass mount antenna. I mean, I went by Kate. He's got the same vehicle as me. And he said right away, no, I need to really put it a glass mount. So I got a glass mount. You know, and, you know, the only question is, I got a glass mount for like $40. You know, if I want to spend over $100 for like a really good one, like another 3/4 of a D. I don't know if it's worth it.
Oh, absolutely not. You ever tune that antenna? The little box that goes on the inside of the glass, a lot of people don't know. You have to put an SWR meter in the line to the radio, and there's a hole, an opening in that little box. Put a stick of a screwdriver in there, and you have to tune it for minimum SWR. I'll bet you didn't know.
No, I didn't. I'm going to look for that little hole. Useful piece of information. If it's there. You know, then again, you know, this is, I got it from FMJ, you know, FMJ, whatever it is. You know, I don't know if their chief antenna has it, but if it does, I'll find it and I'll put it. Useful information, thanks. Yo, this is MC2ZD for him, station ID, back over to you.
Okay, now, and 2EO, the one I had was made by Lawson, a long time ago. Once I tuned that loop thing, you know, I got it as good as any other mobile. The radio is probably cutting back.
I got that. Okay, very good. I'm gonna try doing that. Very good. Well, very useful information. Thank you. Back to you.
What kind of SWR meter do you own? The MFJ is terrible.
I've got a few of them. I haven't used them in so long. I don't remember who the manufacturers are. But I'm pretty sure it's not MFJ. So. I don't know, maybe LBG, I'm not sure. I have to take a look. I have 2 or 3 of them lying around. I have to stick them out of the pile.
Okay, now, might I suggest the DIWA, D-I-W-A-R-I-A? I think that's the way it's spelled. Pronounce DIWA. The meters are excellent. I keep one right now in the line all night. It's great.
You know what? Now that you said the name, I think I have one from them. From must have it 20 over 20 years, 25 years ago or something. I bought one, a Daiwa. I have one. I have to just see if I can find it. Yeah, got all about that one yet? Oh, back to you.
Okay, now, Sally. Yeah, it works fine. I had a couple of MMJs. They were horrible. They were way off, so I got with it.